This is the RightsCast Network at rightscast.net. This is episode 9 of Novel Approaches here on the RightsCast Network. Welcome to the RightsCast Network's Novel Approaches podcast, a craft-focused conversation for writers everywhere.
Because writing novels is hard, but we're all in it together.
Hey there, I'm author, editor, and RightsCast Network founder, R.R. Campbell.
And I'm Sion Ashelman, freelance editor, book addict, and co-host of the Novel Approaches podcast.
In this installment of Novel Approaches, we'll be taking a look at narrative mode, what it is, why it's important, and how we can use it to fuel our stories. But first, Sion, we survived NaNoWriMo.
Woo! Yeah. I wasn't even doing NaNoWriMo, but because we did that event with RevPit where we led teams, you did that too, right?
I sure did.
Yeah. So that was pretty intense for me. I feel like I wrote words vicariously through my team members or something.
It was like an osmosis process, just like that their words existed, suddenly your words came to be, basically.
No, I just sort of like, I felt like I had written the words that I didn't write.
Oh, there's that too. There's that too. Yeah, good.
Yeah. Were you writing?
I was writing, in fact. I was working on the third book in the Empathy series, and this was the first time I did the official NaNoWriMo. Like I think I mentioned in previous episodes, I'd done Camp NaNoWriMo before and just doing revisions, but I was actually writing fresh words for the month, and I did make it, I think, to like just over 51,000 words, which was fun. I was glad to get him done, to get him down, I should say. And also it was really nice to be part of that RevPit event, because I don't know what like the degree of interaction you had with your team was, but it was really great to see, at least in like our Twitter chat, everyone was really cheering one another on every day. There's a lot of really good support. I saw people getting together some writing sprints independent of anything that RevPit or the NaNoWriMo accounts were doing. So it was really sweet. It was really actually cool to see at the end looking at the RevPit spreadsheet and going, look at all these hundreds of thousands of words that people put down this month, and we all got to be part of that. So that was really cool.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's one of the things that I like the best about the RevPit community is how supportive they are of each other. I will say that even though I wasn't, well, I mean, I was just doing my normal writing last month, but I did read a lot more than I usually do for some reason. I read a couple of really good books. I read The First Bad Man by Miranda July. Have you read anything by her?
I have not.
If you like quirky and disturbing and funny and challenging with unreliable narrators done really, really well, and some disturbing sexual proclivities, then I recommend it. I mean, I don't want to give too much away.
And you
it's
said,
not about disturbing sex stuff. It
but
just
it's
happens
in the background.
It's not really background. It's like part of the journey.
Sure. All right. Fair enough. So that was, you said that was Miranda July for listeners who want to check that out. And I'll throw that on now that I'm officially using Goodreads, which I don't know why I wasn't previously, but I can have an actual TBR list so I can add things like it to it. And it'll be there later when I decide I need a new book to read. So there's that. What else did you read last month?
I read The Heart Goes Last by Margaret Atwood, one of my favorites. And that's another near future sort of dystopian thing where, sort of like Mad Atom flavor, but without the big man-made apocalypse.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
And I actually, I literally had that book in my hand at Barnes & Noble when I was back in the Milwaukee area for Thanksgiving. My wife and I were just trying to kill time before this event that we were going to, and we were walking around. I grabbed that one. I had it off the shelf. I put it back. I grabbed it off the shelf, and then I ended up putting it back on the shelf. So now I know. Should have got that one. Should have brought it with me. So another one for the list.
Yeah, but the thing is, there are so many books.
Yeah.
Yeah. My next binge buy is going to be, I don't know how to say it, pronounce it correctly, but Haruki Murakami.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm saying that right, but
I don't either, but it sounds familiar.
Murakami?
Yeah, it does actually, yeah.
Yeah, Kafka on the Shore and IQ84 and Norwegian Wood, and my favorite is Hardboiled Wonderland and the End of the World. That's an amazing book. You would love that book. Cool. You should read that book.
All right, I'm getting all sorts of recommendations. These will end my year and or kick off 2019, so.
Yeah.
Very good.
Anyway, so yeah, so that's kind of what's new with me. Oh, also, I can't believe the main one that I wanted to talk about was I read Accounting for It All.
Oh, you did.
R.R. Campbell.
Oh boy, yes, how fun.
In one sitting.
Oh wow, really?
Well, yeah, because you're so good at that, like fast-paced drawing you in and the chapter breaks making you need to turn the page and all that kind of stuff.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I was really surprised by the first chapter because of how you had talked about it in our previous conversations as more focusing on setup. And I had forgotten, if you did say that there was a big inciting incident there, I had forgotten that you said that. And so when I got to it, I was like, oh.
There it is. It gotcha. It's on like page 2 or 3. Yeah, that's... That actually, I think that chapter was not the first chapter originally, but I decided I wanted to have a big inciting incident really kick things off for the audit that she ends up facing, because I needed a way to like cover for the fact that she somehow got by for years without knowing anything about accounting. And so she needed a cover story, and that cover story, it starts to fall apart after only a few pages, so...
Yeah, well, and I was also really intrigued by your dual timeline storytelling. I was like, I have to admit, I wasn't sold on it at first. I was
no.
like, oh, I was like, I care about what's happening now.
Right.
But it was interesting enough that like, I definitely didn't lose my attention. And then at the end, I was like, yeah, you absolutely needed every moment of that. And
sweet.
I totally get it.
So, yeah, I'm glad it worked out. That was actually, we mentioned Margaret Atwood earlier in this conversation. My decision to do that dual storytelling thing was totally from the first book in the Matt Adams series, Oryx and Crake. I decided to do that after reading that because I thought it was really interesting how in that book she decides to tell, you know, we're just kind of with Jimmy or Snowman in like this post-apocalyptic world, and then over the course of the story we start to see not only how the world came to be, but also like what a critical role this Snowman character actually played in it, even if he was just kind of like an accessory to the crime, so to speak. So I thought that it'd be really neat to like, you know, introduce this timeline. At first you're kind of like, all right, well, we're just seeing what it was like for her to work in the adult industry, but then hopefully, and it sounds like it worked for you anyway, the idea is that it kind of comes together and you get this full enough picture of Robin to help you better understand why she makes the decisions she makes in that present timeline.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it went a little bit beyond motivation for me, but definitely that was a big part of it. It's been a while since I read Oryx and Crake. My memory of it is that very little of that novel takes place in quote unquote present time. Most of it is what happened in the past. And yours is sort of the flip of that,
yeah,
right?
That's true.
Like,
yeah,
most of yours takes place in the present with just enough of the past. I mean, it's significant, the amounts of the past timeline, but it's not like, I don't think it's half even.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, actually, because in Oryx and Crake, there is, I think in the present timeline, only a matter of a few days passes, whereas in the past timeline in that book, we get to see, I mean, a significant part of his childhood up through the time that the apocalypse sets in. So there really is a, yeah, I guess it's a difference in the balance, but it's, I guess it goes to show that if you're using less traditional narrative styles or storytelling styles, that there's a way to make it work for you and your story. So lessons learned.
So that came out mid-November-ish, right?
Yes, it
and
did.
So how's that... How's that going?
Good. You know, I had the book launch party for it on December 1st. So that was just this last weekend at the time we're recording this. It went really well. I had never obviously hosted a book launch party before. I didn't totally know what to expect, but I found that, you know, the more relaxed I tried to make myself get into it and think about it from the perspective of, like, for most of the people here, I'm like a dude who wrote a book to them, and they're not maybe like the biggest readers, they're not in the writing community, so that's just like really cool. And I think once I was like, all right, I don't need to do like a crazy thing with bells and whistles and go super hard. It's just about like thanking everyone for being there, thanking them for, you know, being here in this part of the journey. And then, you know, I did a couple of readings. I released the first of two book trailers for my upcoming sci-fi debut, Empathy Imminent Dawn. So everyone keep your eyes and ears on the internet for that first trailer, which is now out, and the second one will be out in January. So yeah, I mean, it was a fun month to get to the point, you know, midway through where the book was actually and officially out. It's just kind of surreal. It's really hard to describe. You know, people ask like, oh, so how's it feel? And it's like, I don't know. I still refuse to accept that it's a thing. Like, I can reach behind me on a bookshelf and grab a book I wrote. That's a really messed up feeling to have. So, it's exciting, but, I still am not totally sure it's set in, but, it's great. I've really enjoyed the interaction I've got from people. I've got a few emails from readers who have really enjoyed it or connected with it in one way or another. And it's just, I don't know, it's more affirmation that what it is that we do as writers and editors is in some ways like, it just creates this really cool magical connection between people, and having an opportunity to be on sort of this side of that connection is, I've used the word too many times already, but it is surreal, and it's really cool. So I'm looking forward to keeping up with this, no matter how, as we say, writing books is hard, no matter how hard it might be sometimes, I'm looking forward to sticking with it. So,
because you got your next one coming out in not too long.
Yeah, January 28th, Empathy Imminent Dawn, book one of five. So,
five? Yeah. I forgot it was five.
Okay. Yeah, there are five. Wow. So it's, we just wrapped up content edits earlier this week, actually. So it's off to the copy editor. And then, of course, we've got proofreads. We've got formatting. I got permission from my publisher to do some really cool formatting stuff with the print version of the book. So if you are a listener to this podcast who gets a print copy, I'll have some nice little bits of flair in there. I hope I don't go over the top with it, but I'm going to try and bring out character a few different ways in that book too that you wouldn't necessarily see if you just went with, for example, like one font all the way through. So we'll see. We're gonna roll the dice a little bit.
You're going to do, like, new font every page? Is that what you're going to do?
Yeah, that's it. What I'm doing is every vowel will be in Comic Sans, and then all fricatives will be in Courier, and then we'll stick with Times New Roman for sibilance. It's going to be, friend, strap it. It's going to be a wild ride. No.
There you go, showing off your linguistics terminology.
I didn't know how else to categorize them. I don't know. It was on my mind before this conversation. Before this conversation went live, Sion and I chatted for a while, and linguistics came up, so it's fresh in my head. So, but cool. Yeah, so lots of book stuff going on. I'll have some announcements coming out in the near future about some additional speaking opportunities that I'll be doing in 2019 for folks who want to come be part of that. And also, I mentioned, you know, the book launch party. I'm going to be getting some blog posts, or at least a blog post together, on what it's like to host one of those, and some tips, some good case practices, some bad case practices from my experience, so that if you are a listener to this podcast with a book coming out now in the future, or you just are generally interested in this, keep an eye on rrcampbellwrites.com, because I will, I'm going to try and pass along the things I've learned along the way to help you out if I can. So,
I'd also be interested in, just to put a bug in your ear, your experience with the book trailer as a marketing tool.
Yes, and I will do a sort of post-mortem, so to speak, on that. I've already learned a little bit about releasing. The first one that came out was very much, the reason I decided to do two of these, we'll talk about it for a second here since we're on it, is I wanted the first trailer really only to establish mood. It doesn't give you much about plot. It just gives you a rough idea of what, well, not, yeah, it gives you like the month of the book's release. And then I use like, you know, different color, sound, font to introduce folks to what it might be about in general. Whereas the second trailer is going to actually, I worked with a couple of voice actors to bring some of the characters to life. I've got some character art commissioned by Maggie Derrick, who is also an author. She does some really cool, artist drawing work as well, so she'll be bringing the characters to life for the trailer, and we'll see how it goes. So I will definitely, you know, we'll see what works best in terms of getting it out there, getting it in front of people's eyeballs, and seeing what the reactions are. And I, like I said, I'll do a post after the fact too, once I've had enough time to chew over how it went And we'll see if I do one for the second and third and fourth and fifth books. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be interesting to hear about that. You produce them yourself?
Oh, I sure do. I've used my fun little podcast tools here. I did the voiceover for the first trailer. But like I said, I reached out into the community to get some help for trailer number two, but I went ahead and purchased the rights to use some, I wouldn't call it necessarily, I guess it is stock audio, but it's like soundtrack kind of stuff. It's got like a cyberpunk feel to it. I edited that up, and then, you know, you throw in your vocal effects, you write the script, send it off to the voice actors, and then I'll just be using iMovie to cut together all the things that I need for the visual aspect of it. So it's a full multimedia experience. So we will see how it shapes up when it's all said and done. But it is, it's one of those things that I think I'm just grateful to have the opportunity to do kind of on the side here, because I know it is super time consuming and it's probably daunting if you don't have an audio or like visual background, which I've somehow cobbled together over the years. So yeah, we'll see how it goes. People might hate it, and then I'll just delete my presence from the internet altogether. But, you know, just expecting the worst, as always.
Yeah, I don't know how you must live on like 3 hours of sleep a night. That's all I gotta say.
Good 5 to 6, you know, you drink a couple Red Bulls, everybody's happy.
If you say so.
I will keep saying so. I have to keep saying so. It's the only way I'm going to get by. But hey, you know what it's time for? I think it's time for the conversation. Today, we're talking about narrative mode. So this is something that was voted on by listeners to this show, and we'll have a poll up at the end of this show so folks can help choose what the topic for our next episode will be. Listeners chose narrative mode for December's episode, so we should probably start by defining what narrative mode is. So why don't you, Sione, if you would be so kind, define narrative mode for us, and what are our choices in narrative mode?
Yes. Well, so narrative mode is just basically two components, and you smash them together to describe the lens from which you're telling the story. And so it consists of the verb tense you choose and the point of view. And I don't mean what character's point of view. I'll get into that in just a second. So the most common verb tenses are past tense and present tense. And then future is also an option, but it's extremely rare and hard to do without being annoying. I will say that.
Yep, I would agree.
Yeah. I mean, you might be able to sustain it for like a short story or something like that, but for a novel, that would be really tricky. And if you can do it, more power to you. Point of view, POV. So the most common are first person, which is I, right? So first person past tense is I went to the store and then the store blew up.
Inciting incident.
I mean, that happened to me last week. It's really embarrassing.
What?
No, I'm just kidding.
Oh my God, I was going to say, I was like, we need to have a sidebar about that. If you were in like a supermarket explosion that didn't make the news near me. And anyway.
No, sorry. Okay, that was a really terrible joke considering all the crap that happens in the news. I'm sorry.
That's, well, and like fluke things happen all the time. Like we actually had like a bar blow up one town over because there was a random gas leak. I don't think anyone died from it, but it was like a major like, okay, well, everyone check your gas lines kind of thing not long ago. And actually sitting on my desk right now is Donna Tartt's The Goldfinch. And the inciting incident is in that is an explosion at a museum. So I was just like staring at that book when you said it and was like, my God, Sione.
It's fiction come to life.
It is.
No, bad joke. My bad. Okay, so first person, and then the, I'll talk about the next most common in a second. But so another option is second person. And so this can be, so second person is you, right? And the you can be the reader. Like if you think about the, I don't know how many people in the audience ever read those Choose Your Own Adventure books. They were super popular when I was a kid.
Same.
And I devoured them, even though they weren't really that good.
In retrospect, they were fun because you felt like you were there as a child.
You gotta like choose which page you turn to. There was the novelty of it more than anything. I think that's why they didn't stick around. I just read a faux choose your own adventure book recently. It's a creative nonfiction book called Love is Not Constantly Wondering Whether You're Making the Biggest Mistake of Your Life. I talked about that, I think, on our Twitter chat.
Yes, you did.
And so that's written in you, and the you refers to the reader. There's another kind of you where you is another character in the story, but not the reader.
Interesting.
So an example of that are the short stories, or I guess they're flash fiction, in the book Visits to the Confabulatorium by Sora Mimi Hanarejima. And so we'll have a link to that so you guys can check it out. It's available in ebook and print. And then another example of second person is the second person plural, which would be we. I don't think I've seen any stories told in we.
I actually know of one, and I hate to bring it up because I have a pretty strict no Ayn Rand policy on my podcasts, but in Anthem, they use we as the in place of I because she thinks she's really clever, and her thesis in the book is that, like, we live in a world where I has been erased because collectivism has taken over, and it's like, it's a very, you know, Bruce Willis was dead the whole time kind of reveal at the end where the we is just an I. But that's the only one that I can think of that it's ever been used, and it wasn't to especially good effect. So just an example, though, in case someone is really desperate for a book that says we the whole time.
There you go. Yeah, there's your example. And then there's third person, and there are different sort of subcategories of this, but third person, the narrator is usually outside the story, not a character in the story. And the third person narration tends to be what I think of as sort of invisible. It doesn't draw a whole lot of attention to itself as character, like, as opposed to first person, which can get hopefully like really voicey and does a lot of character building through the voice. Third person tends to be more about telling the story. Obviously, there, you know, that's not like a, there's gray areas. But third person limited. So when you're in a point of view, so I'm telling this story from Ryan's point of view, and I'm using he. And so Ryan went to the store and it didn't blow up.
Yay.
Because he saved it.
Yay.
And so that's third person. And then that can either be close or distant. So close is like the closer you are to that character, the more you're getting into their body and into their head. And so that tends to be one of the more popular POVs these days. It's very on trend, is that close, limited third person. And just because it's limited third person doesn't mean you can't switch characters. Usually there's a chapter break or a scene break to switch POVs is the language. I'm realizing the language can be confusing because you're switching character POVs, but you're not switching the POV because you're staying in third person limited.
Very good point.
Right. Yeah. So that's limited. There's third person omniscient, which used to be a lot more popular. Like if you think W. Somerset Maugham, for example. I think of his stories as being written in omniscient, or Pride and Prejudice, because I love to talk about Pride and Prejudice.
Yes.
That's omniscient. And so omniscient is when the narrator knows what's going on in everybody's heads. That one's tricky because you don't want to get into head hopping, but I think you have an episode on head hopping, so I'm going to not...
I do talk about it in Biblio Breakdown. I want to say it's episode 2, and it is in the context of Exit West by Mohsin Hamid, which I might reference a little later in this conversation. So I do address it, though actually in that context, I'm talking about how head hopping was done really effectively because of the way that it was sort of like introduced and stepped out of. But yeah, that's a whole can of worms, and we'll talk a little bit about it later. But yeah, you do run the risk of head hopping with omniscient for sure.
Yeah, and third person omniscient, even though you know what's going on, the narrator knows what's going on for all of the characters, knows what they're all feeling and thinking. It's more distant than close third person limited. And then the most distant is third person objective. And that's not a common one in fiction. If you think about a newspaper article, that's an example of third person objective, where you're only reporting what is said and done, and scenery description. So action, dialogue, and scenery description. And you're not getting into how people feel or what they're thinking at all. Yeah, so those are the types of verb tense and POV. And again, first person and close third person limited are the most common, and present and past tense for those.
Right. So it feels like we really do have, it's interesting because it feels like there are so many different options. I mean, we look at third person, and within that we have our limited, we've got omniscient, we've got objective. And then of course there's first and second person. But like you've said, some of these are way more common, especially now. Some are more common in the past, et cetera. But yeah, essentially what it comes down to most commonly is you're looking at either past or present, and then probably first or third person limited. So if those are the most common, that's great. But I think that perhaps it's worth exploring why it's important to be super deliberate about choosing one's narrative mode when going into a story, or after you've started writing a story, maybe being critical at times about the narrative mode you've chosen to make sure you found the one that works for you. I know that in my experience, this is not something that I have put a lot of deliberate thought into. Most times for me, it's been very much about what feels right. And that's maybe not the best way to do it. For example, I know when I started writing the very first draft of Accounting for It All, I believe I was writing it in third person, limited, and all in the past. And that was fine, but I felt really far away from the main character in that book, because as you know, as someone who's read the book, I ultimately settled on writing it in the first person and writing it actually in a combination of past and present, because I really wanted to be intimate with the character and her emotions. So if I had been a little bit more deliberate in advance of writing, perhaps I could have made that decision ahead of time and saved myself having to go back and replace all my past tense verbs with present tense verbs and then sharpening from there. But I don't know, what are some other reasons, Sion, that you think it's worth being more deliberate about the narrative mode that we choose to work with?
So just to take that question at face value, why is it important? It's because each choice comes with its advantages and limitations. So what you just mentioned is that third person and past tense is more distancing. It distances the reader more from the main character and from the story than a first person present narration does. But also, when you use present tense, you don't have the option of using any foreshadowing or any reflection. Obviously the you can reflect on things that happened in the past, but one of the advantages to using past tense is that from whatever point in time the character is telling the story, or from whatever point in time the story is being told, there's opportunity to reflect on adding details that maybe the character wasn't aware of at the time that fed into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, there's it has to do with like the point at which you are able to give a sort of retrospective on the events.
Yes, thank you. That was much more articulate.
There's a term for that in linguistics I'm like trying to go after too, and it's I think it's not mood. it'll come to me after we're done recording, but that's, I think, why it clicked like that. It's just about your ability. It's about how relative your reflection is, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that's one of the limitations of the present tense, is that then you can't use those devices in order to create some forward momentum. That's really what they're for, or deepen the character. Another example, first person past tense. So again, I went to the store. That makes a promise to the reader that the narrator is going to survive.
Yep.
And so I think sometimes people hesitate because then they're worried that their survival narrative, will be less, have less tension or something around it. But I just read Artemis by Andy Weir.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's his second book.
Yeah, because he wrote The Martian. I actually haven't read Artemis, but I've seen it a few times, yeah.
Yeah, he wrote The Martian. I haven't read The Martian, but I did read Artemis. It's basically like a heist caper gone wrong on the moon base.
Oh, that sounds perfect. I need to read that really soon. It's important for empathy for.
I'm getting a little choked up there.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it a lot. But that's told in first person past tense. And there's even an extra little push at some point in there where the narrator Jazz says, she says something like, I wouldn't know until much later, blah, blah, blah. So saying something like that reinforces that whatever point in time this is being told, she's alive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But actually, there's a, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a moment where Jazz dies.
Not to give too much away, she dies. She dies.
Sort of. Well, anyway, the point is, like, that, and when I got there, like, there was the little part of me saying, okay, but this is past tense, so I know she's alive, she survives. But I believed in that moment she wouldn't. And I'm sorry, everyone who feels like that was too big of a spoiler. It's really not, I promise. Like, it's totally worth reading, and it's going to be, there's lots of twists and turns and lots of things that go wrong. You would really like this one, Ryan.
Oh, yeah. I actually, for all the times I've seen the cover of the book and stumbled into it on Amazon, I never once read the blurb for some reason, but I wish I had taken the extra 2 seconds to do that in the past, because that's totally going on my, I normally just ask for Amazon gift cards for Christmas, and then I go hard on buying books to start the new year, because it's just, you know, you flag it quick and then you grab it. So that's on my list. It's on my list.
Yeah, I picked it up because it was when I was working at Barnes & Noble last year, and it was 20% off on top of my employee discount. And I was like, oh, this is someone that I should read because I like science fiction. He did The Martian, and it was new at that time. And so I picked it up, but I agree with you. The cover does not invite, it's so stark.
Yeah, it's just really slate.
It doesn't reflect... it doesn't reflect the genre except for the hard sci-fi part. Yeah. I thought it was going to be another like The Martian, but it's not. It's a heist caper.
Cool.
Anyway, read it.
Will do. I'll get it on my list.
Yeah. So, okay. So lots of babble, but in short, knowing what each narrative mode's sort of advantages and limitations are, that's why it's important to consider them. I had a client at one point who was telling the whole question of the book was, is the narrator or is the main character going to survive? Like, that's what he wanted. He wanted there to be a lot of doubt, but he was telling it in past tense. Mm. And so I pointed out that wasn't going to be his best choice for that one. So things like that.
Very good. Well, it sounds like those are definitely some good things to consider. I think it's then a matter of choosing the narrative mode that's right for our stories, and that certainly goes hand in hand with everything you've just said. And that actually brings me to a point that I want to bring in from our hashtag, RightsCastChat, that we had about this in the lead up to recording this episode. And this one is from H.A. Lynn on Twitter. She tweets at author H.A. Lynn, and she's hitting on this idea of distance that you mentioned earlier, that I mentioned in my reflections on writing Accounting for It All, and it's this. She says, I feel closer to character when it's written in first person, especially if it's written in present tense. It's more personal, like I'm writing a journal entry, so I find I'm able to fly through the story a bit easier and get inner thoughts and emotional reaction on the page a little easier. So thank you, Heather, for your tweet on that. And I will absolutely second everything she said. For me, if you're trying to tell a very evocative narrative, if you really want to have an opportunity to get in a character's head and really have readers, as much as they can, empathizing with the main character, that first person can really drive that home. Though, as I'm sure we'll talk about a little later, we see it more commonly in some genres compared to others. But I just thought it was nice to hear from her on that.
Well, and what I appreciated about that is that she's talking about her experience writing it, as yes. opposed to what I'm used to thinking about is the experience reading it, right? Because mm-hmm. I'm coming at it from the editor's perspective. Mm-hmm. But I really like that aspect that she's talking about, that for her, she's aware that it's really a lot easier for her to get into the head. And so I think that even if you know that ultimately the story needs to be told in third person because of things that you want to do with the perspective, if it's easier for you to write in first person, then write it in first person. And if it's close third person, really pretty much all you're going to have to do is change the pronoun, because in my book, close third person should be as close, except for the pronoun, as first person, in terms of getting the in-body feelings, in terms of getting that whole, we talked about in the characterization episode a little bit, like what the character observes, what their emotional reaction. So, getting that close into their heads is important for that third person close.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I mentioned it only a minute ago, and I'm looking now at sort of the direction we wanted to take this conversation, and you have a list of some things that's also worth factoring in to the decision-making process, and one of them has to do with genre. So I don't know if you want to take that point and kind of run with it now.
Yeah, sure. And it's, you know, not a big thing in terms of long, but I just think it's important to know what's on trend in your genre, because that's going to tell you what readers are used to, so that if you're going to break the conventions, you can do it intentionally and thoughtfully. One example, it's not recent, but The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, which I had probably talked about many, many times on this podcast because it's one of my favorite books. It switches narrative mode. It's told in first person and also in third person objective. And there might be two first person narrators. It's been a long time since I read the whole thing. I need to reread it. But the way that Le Guin sets up the expectation for that, the first sentence of the second paragraph of the story is, the story is not all mine, nor told by me alone.
Oh, nice. Ugh. Good. That's good.
It. Yeah. And then you're like, oh, okay, this is a book that's going to change narrative mode. Done. So knowing what's common in your genre. And I touched on perspective is another thing to factor in terms of what it is you need the reader to know, and also what it is you want to hide from them, right? Just one example. You can't tell us things that the POV wouldn't know or is outside the chosen POV's purview. So just one example. I started telling a story. This is a short story. I started telling it in first person present tense about a first contact with a particular group of aliens. And then at one point, though, the narrator was like hunched down on the ground, there was an explosion and their eyes were shut, but what I needed the reader to know is that the aliens were still coming toward them across the field. Well, I can't stay in first person present tense and tell that because the narrator's eyes are closed.
Right.
So that wasn't going to work. So I had to change that. But yeah, that's an important thing. And then we talked also about distance. And so you need to think about the distance you want the reader to be able to maintain from the story or the narrator, because there can be an advantage to that. If the main character is very disturbing, right? If their head is a very disturbing place to be, and it isn't somewhere that the reader is going to want to stay for the length of an entire story or novel, then you might want to change that perspective to be third person, because even if it's close third person, it's still more distant than first person, and first person present. So yeah, that's another thing to think about is distance. And the more distant, the limitation there is that the more distance there is between the reader and the narrator or the story is that it's a little bit harder for the reader to engage and really sink into the story. Because as Lisa Crone talks about in her book, Wired for Story, which I've also mentioned ad nauseum because I really love it, we want to, part of what hooks us into story is that we want to feel what the character's feeling. And so the more distance you have, the less likely that is to happen. And then, sorry, just a couple more things, blah, blah, blah.
No, it's good. These are all things worth keeping in mind.
Yeah. Something else that I thought of in preparation for this talk was like when there are gaps in the narrative timeline. So, for example, I'm going to tell part of the story, and then really there isn't anything major. There aren't any scenes I need to show in this, 2 month period, right? Things are kind of on hold, and I can just sort of, gloss over them in a couple lines of exposition. Well, present tense is going to make that really tricky to do that. That works better for past tense. And there are ways to do it. It's not like it's impossible, but if I'm hooked into that present tense, what my expectation is that this is going to be told in quote unquote real time, right? That it's going to cover a span of time that feels, it's not going to skip over years and months. Exception, if it's epistolary, if you're doing a diary entries or something like that, then you can have gaps in time. And an example of that is Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. Sower.
I'm shrugging aggressively on the video feed. I don't know.
S-O-W-E-R. I just realized.
Sower, probably.
Because it's referring to sowing of seeds.
Yeah, probably sower.
Parable of the Sower.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm embarrassed that I've been pronouncing that incorrectly this whole time.
That's okay. Everyone probably just thought it was spelled S-O-U-R.
Or, yeah, exactly. And then the last thing that you might want to take into account when you're deciding, choosing your narrative mode is what your strengths are. First person is a great way to capitalize on your voice, getting it really voicey. And actually, when you're doing first person with a really voicey narration, you can get away with a little more exposition than you can in third person, for example. The pitfall, though, tends to be the temptation to spend too much time in the character's head, or too much time in exposition and too little time in scene. At least that's what I've found in the manuscripts that I've read in first person. Or like close third person, which still needs a sense of voice, but you can also do a third person option where the narration is pretty much the same voice. And then the individual characters' voices come through more in the dialogue, for example. Third person, the pitfall can be forgetting to create a connection with the POV character by revealing their in-body feelings and that observation, feeling, interpretation thing that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, so. And I'll say on top of that, one thing that's worth considering is that if you are writing, as we'll touch on, well, actually, I don't know, we'll just touch on it now, I guess, in narratives that are told from multiple points of view, and I don't mean like switching narrative mode, I mean literally having like one character and then jumping into another character over a chapter break, for example, is that if you want to write a story like that, and let's say you have, you know, a small handful of perspective characters, if you write that in the first person, it's going to be super important that every voice be distinct, and you really have to, like, you have to have such a strong sense of character to be able to maintain and keep up a unique voice for more, I would say, like, 3+, if you're starting to work in that range. That can be a real challenge. It's still a challenge, I think, to an extent, if you're writing it in third person, but like you said, there is this option to maintain a very similar narrative sort of voice, or the narrator's voice can kind of remain the same across these perspectives. And then the dialogue is where we really get that change in voice to come out. So caveat escritor, I guess they would call it. Like, if you're going to sit down and write a multi-perspective narrative and first person is a strength for you, that's great, but just really make sure that you get those voices to be distinct on the page, because what's really great about those is if you can just pick up on any page and know which character you're reading, but if that gets to be confusing for your readers, then it might be worth shifting that over into third person, only to make sure that there is clarity with what actions are happening to which characters and when.
That's a great point. Absolutely. 100%. And that kind of segues into the next question that we wanted to talk about, because you were talking about switching between characters, and we talked a little bit about mixing or swapping or changing narrative modes during, like, within a single story. Have you read any books that do this effectively?
Yeah, this year I've actually read two books. I started the year reading, I mentioned it a little earlier in this episode, I started the year reading Exit West by Mohsin Hamid, and then I also reread Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides this year, and both of them change narrative mode over the course of the story. Exit West, for example, I talk about it extensively in Biblio Breakdown episode 2 for anyone who's interested in going really deep with this. It's at rightscast.net/podcasts/Biblio Breakdown. You can find it on that page. But it really has this cool, what I could only characterize as a zoom in, zoom out feature, where it starts really intimate with like one particular character. And then over the course of these really long, winding, really nice flow sentences, or a paragraph even sometimes, we slowly zoom out from that individual character, and we get this like global view of what's happening around them, and then sometimes from that global view we zoom back in but to a different character. So it almost, like, I hesitate to say that it's omniscient, because it gets so intimate. It's really, I don't know, it was really difficult for me to classify, but it definitely plays around with this idea of like the ability to do head hopping in a way that I would normally as an editor be like, well, you know, this is a head hop, but it's done just so well that I don't know, I couldn't help but be super into it. So I have a ton more on that if anyone wants to check out that Biblio Breakdown episode. But I think maybe the more salient example of switching narrative mode in a very direct and clear-cut way is Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides. He does a very similar thing to what Le Guin does in the book that you referenced earlier. I believe very similar way at the start of the book, talking about how this is kind of a family saga. And so though the main character is sharing their experience as they've grown up in, you know, a world that went through turbulent times, it actually also goes back to, I believe it's during the Second World War thereabouts, talking about the relationship shared by their grandparents. And at times we slip into first person present and we're suddenly the grandfather. Other times we slip out of that and we're getting third person, like it's being told to us by our narrator, who is like technically the main character, though they're not on the page for, you know, chapters and chapters at a time once in a while, because we're doing this sort of like I said, it's a long-term family saga. So that one slips in and out of third person, uses first person, we get past, we get present. It's very intimate at times, and other times it's very distant because it's being told like this sort of like Greek tragedy at times. It like brings in this really cool feel to the prose where we get almost like such a great distance from it. It feels like we're listening to, you know, Homer tell us a tale around a, you know, a fire thousands of years ago. So that one's a real, real great example of how narrative mode can be switched effectively if it's done super deliberately. It doesn't do it constantly, and I think it's important to point out, it's not like, hey, we're spending one paragraph in third person past, and now in the next paragraph it's first person present. It is broken up over the course of scenes. We normally see the transition happening over scenes or over chapters, and it is in this very judicious series of changes over the course of the book that I think is one of the many reasons that it won a Pulitzer. So yeah, definitely check that one out if you have any interest in shifting narrative mode, or just in general if you're looking to read like one of these epic sagas about identity and about changing times and identities within turbulent times. It's a good one to read. So that's definitely one that I would recommend checking out. Are there any that you can think of, or anything come to mind for you in this regard?
Yeah, I mean, I have a specific example and then a for example. But an epistolary novel can use a mix of narrative modes. So for example, you could have a news article, which is third person objective in past tense, and you could have diary entries, which are first person present. You could have firsthand accounts, etc. And a good example of this type of, I say epistolary because it doesn't have to just be letters and diary entries. It can go beyond that to other forms of writing. But Ursula Le Guin, I'm going to talk about her again. So, The Left Hand of Darkness. But also a lot of her Hainish world short stories, which I just recently read. It's a great big collection that was actually two collections mashed into one that's called The Unreal and the Real. And so there are a bunch of heinous short stories in there that have been influencing my writing a lot lately. and then the sort of for example, I must have read a book that did this, but I don't know what it was. But if the narrative could start in past tense and then switch to present tense when it reaches a crucial moment, meaning for example, it's like a first person narrator, and it explains how they came to be stuck in a shoddy homemade rocket that's about to launch. And then for the last like 20% of the book, we learn in present tense what happens at launch time and after. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
In this hypothetical example, switching to present tense would increase the tension and stakes, because present tense, we're no longer certain whether the narrator is going to survive. Like they could blow up in this launch. And they're broadcasting it in real time because they think they're probably going to blow up, and they just want their story out there before they die.
Right. Yeah.
So those are the two examples that I could think of. Yeah.
Well, very good. I mean, I think the takeaway there is that though there is often, I mean, most books, I would say the overwhelming majority of books, you're going to have a narrative mode. You're going to pick a narrative mode. You're going to stick with that narrative mode. But there are certainly ways that you can play with this a little bit for effect. You know, I think the takeaway here is really that you can play with these things as long as you're being deliberate and recognize that there are ramifications for the choices that we make where picking something so foundational as narrative mode is concerned. So, very good. Well, I think we actually have a couple of listener questions here. looks like we've got one from Cinna, who is a frequenter of the RightsCast chats. One thing that he is curious about is what he calls narrative lensing, which to him is how a character's POV shapes their description, their version of events, or it's just the lens on camera, so to speak. Every narrator has a point of view, is what he's getting at. So I was kind of reflecting on this because at first my understanding of what he meant by narrative lensing had to do with this sort of zoom in, zoom out feature that I was talking about with Exit West by Mohsin Hamid. But after he had an opportunity to kind of clarify what he was going for, it actually made me think a little bit about examples from the Empathy series, which I'm obviously in the throes of writing right now, because this is a multiple perspective narrative. I've mentioned it in the past, you know, book one has four perspective characters, book two has nine, book three is at 12. So one of the ways that I kind of work in this idea of lensing, at least my understanding of lensing, for example, is in Imminent Dawn, the first book in the series. I have this character of Wyatt. He is sort of, he, you know, kind of pulls from the mad scientist trope. He's not especially religious, for example. So instead of invoking God in certain phrases, you know, like, oh God, or like God forsaken, or for God's sake, he throws in the names of like famous scientists and physicists as just like a little quirk that he has. So like, for Turing's sake, or I recently just threw this into the manuscript, instead of using God forsaken, I say Hawking forsaken. So it's a little like flair that you can throw in there, I think, too. You know, it kind of ties almost into voice in a way, because when we start talking about the way that a character sees the world, if we're writing from, and this is, I'm writing from third person limited, POV, so we're not talking about first person here, but there are still opportunities to bring that voice out through dialogue or through little quips about thoughts and reflections that they have that can really bring out their lens and how they're viewing the world. And that also ties into, for example, how characters literally define their own existence or define the observations that they make. So for example, in book two in the series, in Mourning Dove, I have this character who is super into video games, and they tend to view things through that lens. So there's this one point, I believe it's earlier on in the manuscript, he comments that he always kind of feels like player two in someone else's game, because he just doesn't feel like he's ever really in control of his destiny. He's got a lot of goals, he's got things that he knows he wants to do, but what's happening to the people around him always feels like it's such higher stakes, because it kind of is. And he's kind of along for the ride, but he's such a useful person to them. But he's got these like aspirations for himself that keep getting put on the back burner because he's always helping others. So rather than using a phrase like, oh, I always feel like I'm on the back burner, he views it as he's like the little brother who is always stuck playing, you know, player two when they sit down to play video games and things like that. So that's another way that I think narrative lensing could be, you know, interpreted. It's kind of about voice, for example.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely. I think his question's a lot about voice, but also maybe about, because we did have that episode on characterization that we did with.
That was with Kristen Oakley.
Right? Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. And then I was like, oh no, did I get the wrong person?
Nope, you're right.
Yeah, with Kristen. And we talked to some length about how, characters' backgrounds inform the way that they view the world. And of course, and I really love your examples of how their worldview comes through, their points of reference come through in their language too. So yeah, I think that's...
Yeah, and I'll say, since you mentioned that episode, I would say anyone who's interested in going super in-depth about ways that narrative lens and voice can be shaped should totally check out that episode, because as I hear you speaking about it now, I'm thinking about, we had a long list of things that it's worth considering to help shape a character's viewpoint of the world, how they interact with it, what their attitudes are toward it. So that one's going to be at rightscast.net/podcasts/novel approaches, which is where this podcast will be as well. So if you're able to make it to that page, or if you just get to rightscast.net and search that one out, you should be able to find it there. But we do have another question here. This one is from KJ Alexander. Do you want to take this one? I can ask you, and if you have any thoughts on this. Sure.
So KJ asks, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about following prose rules while writing in the first person. Does maintaining the voice of the character, especially if a young character, allow for quote-unquote looser writing? So what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that if the heart of this question is about being loose with things like grammaticality, I think that that definitely can be put to use more often when you're using a first-person perspective. So examples, characters who might always get certain things wrong. The thing that came to mind to me was not from a book, but rather a TV show, which is Trailer Park Boys, which I don't know, Sion, if you're familiar with that show or if listeners will be familiar, but there's this character of Ricky who is like, he's just kind of a bumbling doofus. And one of the little character quirks that he has is that there are common idioms that, you know, you would hear every day. And he just says them wrong. He just says them a little wrong. And you still know what he means. And everyone, you know, in the earlier seasons, I think people give him a little side eye for it, but then it just kind of blends in. And that's an example of you could get away with something like that in a book. And I did that a couple times in Accounting for It All, but I didn't want to overplay my hand on it because that's something that, like, if I had chosen to make it idiom specific, then it would have felt too much like Ricky to me. And that is not the angle I was trying to work with my main character. But there are definitely things that, you know, grammatical things or grammatical tics that Robin has in Accounting for It All that wouldn't necessarily be considered correct, so to speak. But we're able to stitch them in there at times just so that we can get a sense of things like her attitude toward the world, her attention to detail, and perhaps her background from an educational standpoint as well. So there are definitely reasons one might choose to be quote-unquote looser with rules about grammar or things like that, from my perspective anyway.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and there's also like regionalisms. There's like, and there are also family focused things that people say. Somebody once taught me, one of my earliest German phrases was something that someone taught me that was really just a thing in her family. It wasn't beyond that, but it was Klappe tu auf ein Tut. I don't know if I'm saying it right, but roughly translated, it means monkey dead, lid closed.
Wow.
Yeah. So kind of, you know, it's a conversation stopper. It's like monkey dead.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right. Like, don't beat a dead horse, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah. And so that's getting, again, what we're talking about is getting into voice, which comes from characterization. One example that I thought of, one of my favorite stories, the story that actually got me into George Saunders, is called John, J-O-N, and it's first person narrative being written down by that character, and so it uses non-standard spelling and grammar because that's a really important part of this character's background and the world building. So if KJ's talking about loose in terms of grammar and spelling and things like that, I think if there's a good reason for it, and it contributes something essential to the characterization or the world building, then yes, absolutely. I think sometimes people get carried away a little bit with spelling out dialect and accents and things like that. A little goes a long way in those respects. But the other thing that I was thinking KJ might mean, looser in terms of having the prose not be as efficient.
Interesting. So like meandering more, maybe?
Maybe a little more meandering, yeah. I mean, there's definitely stream of consciousness narratives, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And maybe sounding a little more like spoken English. I think you just have to find that sweet spot, because if you've ever done that exercise where you go out in public, maybe to a coffee shop or a restaurant or something, and you write down verbatim what is happening at the table behind you or next to you, when people speak, or even if you tried to do it for this episode,
right,
just for
I'm
like
sure.
2 minutes, there's a lot more ums and pauses and abandoned sentences and things like that. And even though it would be authentic to write like that, it would also be really annoying. And it would be really hard to maintain your audience engagement through an entire, my opinion, through an entire book like that. I wouldn't want to read a book written like people actually speak. I think that it needs to always be more efficient. And that's the advantage to writing in my book.
Yeah, and I'll throw in an additional note on that, and this will probably be the last time I reference linguistics for the day, but I think to, you know, further provide reason for why it's worth maybe not writing your dialogue as people actually speak in real life is because in conversation between you and me, for example, there's so much context that's just immediately available that when writing a book, we have to provide that context to an extent. But because we have to be economical about the context we provide, you know, readers and as we write, we can't possibly put down on the page the amount of information that you and I have just like coming to our senses right now, to, you know, our auditory senses, to our visual senses and all of that jazz. And it all ties into implicature, which is this concept from semantics where you and I are sitting in a room. You're sitting nearby a window. The window is open. I say, it feels a little cold in here. Okay, I said it feels a little cold in here, but you know, because you're sitting by a window and you can feel a cool breeze coming in, that I might actually not just be making a statement about the temperature, but asking you to close the window.
And I mean, you're doing that high context culture passive aggressive thing.
It's a, yeah. Yes, it totally is.
Yeah. What you really mean is, could you please close the window? But what you say is,
Exactly. And that's like a classic example. And I use that one in accounting for it all, because I, like you said, being from the Midwest, this is a thing that we do all of the time, much to one another's frustration. In fact, like, for example, I don't answer yes or no questions. This was not pointed out to me until my wife and I were already like engaged to be married. She was asking me all these questions and I would give these answers that would like say yes or no, but I could never just say yes or no. And it's just, I don't know. It's this like social contract that we have, and it's really hard to navigate social contracts super in depth in a narrative that's written down, because as writers, we must create the social contract first before meaning can be divined from a social contract. But because we can't spend 40 pages describing a social contract to set up a story, we have to kind of do all of these things at once. And that's where we end up writing dialogue that doesn't sound like the dialogue you and I are having, but rather sounds like something between, you know, the dialogue we're having and like some really cardboard cutout, you know, stock dialogue stuff. We got to find this nice little medium in between where we have an opportunity to work with the context we have provided readers without going so hard in sounding quote unquote authentic that we alienate our readers and we make meaning inaccessible to them because they're not in the room in the same way that you and I are in our respective rooms having this conversation right now.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's well said.
So that's my long rant for the day. Implicature, folks, look it up. And actually, semantics is my least favorite part of linguistics, but that's the one thing I remember from semantics courses. So I think that we've covered a lot of what we set out to cover here today. I don't know if you have any final thoughts on this topic before we wrap it up.
Well, I guess what I was thinking toward the end there is just something that we've mentioned a few times now in this series, because what we touched on today was not only about narrative mode, but we also talked about voice, we also talked about characterization. And so what that brings up for me again is like, it's so hard to talk about these things as if they were discrete objects. It's all related. It's all a big messy ball. And so we try and like pull out threads and talk about it like it's its own thing, but it really is dependent on lots of other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the same issue that folks who study ecosystems run into, or like if you're a biologist and you're into a particular species and you need to answer questions about, say, its diet or like certain behavioral things that it does. If you study them in isolation, it can only get you so far until you understand the role that it plays in this broader circle of life. And that's kind of, I think, what we get out of these conversations. So I'm glad you pointed that out, because it was true throughout this conversation. It's been true throughout our past conversations in this series, and I'm sure that will be the case going forward. So speaking of going forward, hashtag segue, we're going to have opportunities for further engagement, as we always do. You listeners, as always, can help us pick our next topic for the Novel Approaches series. Shortly after this episode debuts, I will be putting up on Twitter a poll that will be up for a week, and you can help us choose the topic for our next conversation. This poll will feature some familiar choices that we have seen go up for votes in the past, as well as a new one. This particular poll for our next episode's topic choice will include the options of chapter breaks, writing from multiple points of view, and third option, storytelling. There'll also be a fourth choice where you can put in an other if you want to, rally your friends or a bot army on Twitter to vote in favor of a fourth thing that you make up. Go for it. If that's how you choose to spend your time, all the power to you. But again, those categories are going to be possibilities, I should say, are going to be chapter breaks, writing from multiple points of view, and third option, storytelling. And maybe, do you think I should give a little more context for third option storytelling? Does that seem fair? Yeah, Sione is nodding.
A little bit, because you made that up.
I did make that up. As I said, third option storytelling, I made up. I didn't make up the idea of it, but I made up how I chose to frame it as third option storytelling. So if you're interested in learning more about it, here's a quick sample. The idea is that rather than settling on the first or second thing that comes to mind while we're writing, if we can push ourselves to get into the third image that comes to mind, the third choice that comes to mind, we can, as writers, avoid stumbling our way into cliche or borrowing perhaps too much from our favorite favorite authors. But also, third option storytelling is about pivot points in narrative structure. So it's when characters are given option A or option B. If you have a character that can find a way to create an option C, that's a really great way to keep readers on their toes, and it's a really great way to show some ingenuity on the part of your protagonist or the characters that are supporting them. So third option storytelling is a ground that I think there's some fertile territory to explore there, so that's worth diving into a little bit more for anyone who's interested in hearing about that. But that will be one of the choices available to you for this Twitter poll. So once we have selected the next conversation topic, we will of course have a hashtag WritesCast chat about it on Twitter based on your feedback. So stay tuned to our Twitter feed at WritesCast for more information about the next episode topic, as well as the date and time for the WritesCast chat. So thank you as always for joining us on this episode of Novel Approaches here on the WritesCast Network.
For more writerly podcast content like this, visit writescast.net or follow us on Twitter at writescast. I'm also on Twitter at writelearndream, and I'd love to connect with you and hear what you're working on.
And I am over on Twitter as at @IamRRCampbell. Before we say goodbye, I want to thank the WritesCast Network's patrons at patreon.com/WritesCast. Patrons of our programming get access to all sorts of writerly perks, including stickers, votes in the annual WritesCast Awards, which I've got to get rolling shortly here, and at the higher levels of support, patrons of our programming can also get partial manuscript critiques.
Seriously? I didn't know that.
They can, that's yes. Awesome. It's if you support us at the $2 or $3 per episode level, you can get a free 5 or 10 page critique. So it's not a ton, but it's definitely an opportunity to get some feedback, especially if you are considering working with me in particular as an editor and you kind of want to show your support for these podcasts and also get a feel for what it is that I can bring to you in a developmental edit or a 50 page edit or what have you. So of course, those options exist there.
I like it. We'd especially like to thank Kristen Oakley, whose contributions at the Wise Mentor level get her shout-outs in every WritesCast Network episode, on top of all the other great patron awards she receives.
Yes, so to learn more or become a patron yourself, you can visit patreon.com/WritesCast. That's patreon.com/WritesCast. Next up on the RightsCast Network, I'll be putting together an episode on book launch parties, kind of like I alluded to at the start of this episode. So we'll be talking about what a book launch party is, things to consider when planning one of your own, and how to make the most of your time at the event. So stay tuned for that episode to debut, which will debut on December 21st, assuming I get the script for it done in time, but I'm sure I will. One more Red Bull can't hurt, right?
That's it for this episode of Novel Approaches. Thanks for listening.
Until next time, you know what to do. Write on and write well. This is the RightsCast Network at RightsCast.net.